Welcome, everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as to promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club's website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange-colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. And I would suggest you do it because there's an illustration tonight, so you really need to see what the image looks like. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also have an EchoLink node available for use. Just point your EchoLink application to the node KC2RC-R. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month, and this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for any future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the technical net or via email. Our email address is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Roy. This is Bob, KD2NVB. Hope a bunch of you are out there and looking forward to a good net tonight. Back to you, Roy. There's a little bit of hum in your signal. I can hear you just fine, so it's not a problem.
Okay, that's interesting because there's a little bit of hum in your signal as well. Maybe it's something little strange with the repeater. Hopefully, I've redialed and reswitched and reset most of everything, so I'm not going to have a problem that I've been having for the previous few weeks. Ultimately, it was the signal link. One of the knobs, I must have banged into it and changed the setting on one of the knobs. There are so many dials, knobs, buttons, software, and hardware that go into me accomplishing this through EchoLink and all. It's maddening at times. But nevertheless, we on with the show. And as always, someone is calling me on the phone. Same guy who called me, I think, 2 weeks ago during the other technical net. So I guess he doesn't remember once again. Anyway, this is AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If you have any questions or comments for tonight, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign, whether you have a comment or you have a question. Well, there's something. I don't know what's going on. I haven't heard any check-ins. There are people who have showed up on the EchoLink, and I appreciate that. It's nice to have a little bit of redundancy there, because if my connection, my secondary connection to the Echo Link drops out, then I stop being able to transmit, and I have to run around and reconnect to Echo Link. So the more people on Echo Link, the less likely that's going to happen. But nevertheless, once again, I am AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if there's anyone out there with any questions tonight, or comments, or topics for discussion, then please feel free and hit that push-to-talk button. And Rich, I see you on the Echo Link. I couldn't answer you on the phone because I'm doing this. So if anyone out there has any questions, please feel free to hit that push-to-talk.
KD2, CKD, Theodore.
Okay, Theodore, I got you down.
Roy, I've got a quick question about a gamma match for a new antenna design I'm working on, and looking at coils because I don't have the ability to do a counterpoise. So how much space should I allot for the coil from a straight cable? Any idea?
I'm not quite sure exactly where the coil. The coil is going to be past the feed point. Is that what you're saying?
The coil will be past the feed point, and I am expecting it to be in the antenna itself. I don't have a lot of space to play with. These are all antennas that need to fit in a window. And the dipole is working fine, but I'd like to actually have access to some other frequencies. And 2 meters is nice, but I'd like to do 10.
Okay, so I think basically what you're asking is you have a electrically shortened either vertical or dipole, and you want to mechanically short, and you want to electrically lengthen it by putting a loading coil. Is that what you say?
Yes, affirmative.
Okay. Usually, if you look at most designs, they put the loading coil close to the base, close to the feeding point. They do not do that because it's efficient. They do it because it is mechanically the most stable, because you would be introducing a significant weight if you placed at any other point. But technically speaking, that is probably the least efficient place to put a loading coil. Coils have coupling losses and insertion losses, and the closer you are to the center feed or the feed line, the higher your current. Your current maximum is near the feed point, and your voltage maximum is at the very edge of your antenna. So as far as efficiencies are concerned, if you could mechanically handle it, the farther you place the loading coil away from the base, the more efficient the antenna will probably act. Ultimately, most people really don't want to put it at the very top because it weighs down the antenna and it's really a structural problem. So a lot of people with all that understanding compromise, and they put the loading coil in the center of the radiating element. But the most efficient is towards the top. But, you know, the amount of difference isn't that humongous if you put it in the middle. But if you put it in the base, it's the most mechanically stable but least efficient.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Roy, this is Rich, W2BZ, with a comment. I'm on Echolink, as you know, so I'll just keep on going. He was cutting in and out of Echolink anyway, and I didn't hear what kind of antenna that he was building, but I know for HF antennas with a loading coil like I built, there's a very specific distance from the center that you're supposed to put a coil, depending on what you want to do with the antenna. And so I built a shortened end-fed half-wave, and I think it was 23 feet from the center that they wanted the coil of 34 microhenries, and now want to build an 80-meter loaded inverted V, and they're suggesting 12 feet, the loading coil of 67 microhenries, microhenries, and then another 24 feet of wire. I think the coils that go at the base of antennas are mostly for verticals. That's what I've learned so far. So hopefully you heard this, and I'll turn it back to you, Roy. And then I have a comment a little later on about I solved my nano VNA problem, and if other people have nano VNAs, maybe they can solve their problems, but by what I found. Okay.
Okay, very good. Rich, you're right in that when you are putting a loading coil to change the resonance and the harmonics of half-wave end feds, it's important where you're putting the loading coil. In the case of Theodore, he was taking, my belief was, either a 2-meter quarter wave or center fed dipole. So in those cases, it's a mono band, and it's not really important where the loading coil is placed on the radiator. It ultimately has approximately the same effect of electrically lengthening the antenna to be resonant at, say, 10 meters, which Theodore is planning. What becomes more important for those type of antennas is the amount of insertion loss and coupling loss of the loading coil as it relates to the distribution of currents, which are different in quarter-wave verticals and half-wave center feds. So I was directing my answer not in terms of end-fed that you have, but in terms of Theodore's basic question. When it comes to verticals, I'm sure you have seen, most of the time you've seen a base-loaded quarter wave verticals, shortened verticals, but they also come in the middle of the radiating antenna because it's more efficient. And theoretically, if you brought it higher up, it would be even somewhat more efficient, but it would be mechanically unstable. So in your case of an end-fed half wave, you're right. It's important where you locate the inductor. In the case of Theodore's question, it only really ultimately affects the efficiency of the antenna and the structural stability of it.
Now, most of the designs that I've seen for homemade verticals, and they want to add a band, and in this case, Theodore wants to add 10 meters, they always put the, maybe it's just a mechanical consideration, probably so, Roy, but they always put the coils that they wind at the base. I guess thinking about it, some of them are big coils, like for 40 and 80, so you can't put them in the middle of any kind of vertical. So I guess they're doing it just for mechanical reasons, right?
Yes, that's the reason. The most important thing is not to have your antenna break, I guess. So you'll eat the inefficiencies and make it up by the fact that you won't have to build a new antenna every week when your antenna snaps in half because you've weighted it too high up to the antenna to the top of the antenna. So that's purely a mechanical reason. There's no benefit of putting a loading coil at the base other than the mechanical aspects. It is a much more lossy situation because the currents are highest at the base. And so any device that's going to have insertion loss and capacitive coupling losses is going to have more of an effect in an area of the antenna where the current is the highest. So although you're paying for it in efficiency, you're dealing with a structure that doesn't have to be fixed regularly. So that's the reason for the base loading in all of these models.
Alpha Charlie 2 Zulu Victor.
Yes, William. Can I do you for?
I just wanted to make a comment if I could, if there's time for that.
Sure, you can make a comment, William.
I think I heard what Theodore was trying to do was that there's some kind of dipole on his window, and he's trying to, like, make that to extend it out to, like, 10 meters. So I think what needs to happen is he needs to explain to us more about what's going on with the way that this thing is actually attached to the window that it actually works, and then think about what everybody said, and then putting the loading coil at the end is not a mechanical disadvantage because you can bolt it to the wall. So I'm just wondering, like, if let's say you had like a 2 meter dipole on the window, how much coil would you have to put at the end of it, you know, which is where the voltage is, to go 10 meters out of it? So anyway, that's my comment. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, you're quite right. I mentioned the mechanical aspects. If you've designed the antenna in such a way that the added weight at the edges is not going to sag or drag it down, then you certainly can experiment with the inductors farther away than the feed point. So you're quite right. It depends upon the mechanical integrity of the whole thing, and if he feels as though he can secure the edges despite the extra weight, and he wants to experiment with a somewhat more efficient design, he could put it either in the middle or he could put it closer to the end, and get a little bit more benefit from that.
So I have a comment.
W2BZ, that's a big frequency jump from 144 megacycles down to 28 megacycles. I can't imagine what the size or the inductance value of a loading coil would be for that, and if it's even possible. I didn't hear the beginning of his comments, so maybe he has a design that he's already seen, but I've never seen one that does that big a frequency jump.
In theory, you could make any shortened, you know, a good old Dick, K2REW, used to do the thing on the infinitesimal dipole, and the whole point of his discussion it was that you can have any size inductor you theoretically want, and by introducing enough additional inductance to the antenna, you can make it resonant at almost any frequency. There's a price to be paid. If everyone could simply take a whip antenna that's maybe 3 inches long and then load it with a loading coil and get the same benefit of a full-size antenna, that would be kind of wonderful, but no one can do that because the laws of physics don't quite let you get away with things. You pay prices in all kinds of things. As you shrink the mechanical size of an antenna and compensate with a loading coil, you decrease the radiation resistance, and that makes it less efficient. Radiation resistance is effectively like resistance, but in real resistance, the energy is lost in waste heat. In radiation resistance, the energy is lost, with an air quote, into electromagnetic waves, which is the whole point of the exercise. The lower your radiation resistance, the more insertion losses have an effect on your efficiency. So it is possible to have a mobile hamstick that's designed to resonate at 160 meters, that has a relatively short whip. The price that you pay is because of that problem of radiation resistance. The overall efficiency of that antenna can often be less than 1%, which is not good at all. Also, the Q will go up as you do this. High Q means a narrow bandwidth, which means that you have to correct the resonance for any kind of significant change in the frequency. Low Q bandwidth antenna is a broad bandwidth, and a high Q is a very, very, very narrow one. So there's a price to be paid. It is possible to convert a 2-meter dipole to a 10-meter, but again, you're going to have decreased radiation resistance, high Q, and decreased efficiencies. But if that's the only room that Theodore has to put an antenna, better something low efficiency than nothing.
KD2, ZKD, comment.
Theodore. Yes, Theodore. I don't know if you heard me.
Well, I don't know where Theodore went, but maybe a ham stick, a small 10-meter ham stick, if he could ground it, would be the way to go.
Well, you know, he has very limited space. He's doing this, I think, on a window, and not a very big window. So he doesn't really have a lot of space. We've mentioned before, you know, maybe a 10-meter ham stick with a trailing counterpoise and have it poke out the window would be nice. I'm just trying to answer his particular question that, yeah, he can load up a dipole and make it resonant at 10 meters if he wants to. It's just going to be a very low efficient antenna, but low efficient antennas are better than nothing. Even a ham stick, depending upon how short the whip is, that's not going to be terribly efficient as well, but, you know, probably a little bit better because the whip will probably be a bit longer. But I don't know what happened to Theodore. I thought I heard him initially respond, and then he seemed to be cut off. So let's see if he can respond to this time.
22 ZKD, Theodore, comment?
Yes, I hear you, Theodore.
Hey, Roy. Sorry, I've been trying to butt in, and thanks for all the help, guys. But yeah, it is on a windowsill. It is very small space. I'm talking to you right now on a 2-meter inverted V quarter wave dipole, and I have to play with. It's kind of like a counterpoise is not even in the cards. I have 23 inches across, 30 inches high, and 3 inches wide.
Okay. We all are dealing with compromise antennas. Some are greater compromises than others. I don't want to dissuade you. Give it a try. Again, theoretically, the laws of physics will let you resonate any length antenna with a proper inductor placed in its path to overcome the excessive capacitive reactance of a shortened antenna. Whether or not it ends up giving you the amount, the efficiency that you need to hear and be heard, that you'll only know until after you try to build one. But I would suggest that you try because at the very least, it's a learning experience. And you might get lucky, and propagation is rather incredible on 10 meters, so you might get away with some good contacts. You never know.
W2BC again. It's a little tough coming in through Echolink, but Theodore, I'm wondering where did you get the specifications for the coil, the inductance of the coil? Was there a design somebody had? And do you know that you could wind a coil, for yourself and know you have the right inductance? I bought myself an LCR meter, so I knew that my coil was right on 34 microhenries. You could only do that with an LCR meter. They're inexpensive. You can get one for $30 on Amazon or $20 from Alibaba, AliExpress. Also, with a ham stick on a mobile lip base mount, I should say, you can close the window on that. You just put it right outside the window, then close the window on it, and it takes up, a quarter of inch horizontally, a quarter inch or a little bit more maybe, and then it goes up a couple of feet. So you can put a hamstick right outside your window, you know, in stealth mode. Anyway, that's what I would try. Again, I wonder where you got the values for the inductor, for the coil itself.
KD2ZKD, Theodore, yeah, I am still working this out on paper, and I don't have a coil, but I realized that I need to lengthen it, and I was looking for some guidance.
Okay, there are some websites I come across where if you give them the frequency and the length of wire, they usually kind of give you a thumbnail, you know, approximation of how many microhenries of an inductor you might be able to use to shift its resonance up to something like the 10-meter band. I don't recall what they are, but if you Google them, I'm sure you'll find them. They're web page-based calculator pages. So you just plug in the numbers and they give you a value. And they might not be spot on, but they'll give you a rough approximation.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that answers my question.
Okay, very good. I appreciate you participating. Rich, you want to mention how you fixed? Rich had some erratic problems with his nano VNA in the last few weeks. Bizarre results, resistors that should show a straight line sweeping across frequencies of the resistance value of the resistor wasn't doing that. Previously, an antenna was showing multiple peaks and valleys that were not really characteristic of it. So, Rich, you want to tell people how you fixed your nano VNA?
I do, and hopefully if anybody has a nano VNA, this will save you a lot of headaches. You know, I may not be the smartest ham out there, but I do have an intuition about electronics. And it didn't seem to me that there was something with the nano VNA that was permanently messed up, to use a non-electronic term, permanently messed up. It was all erratic, giving me different readings. I would attach an antenna, and the readings with the SWR trace would be all over the place. So I wouldn't give up on this thing, and I kept on poking around and poking around in the menu system, and there I see, you know, reset and enter DFU. I forgot what DFU stands for. You have to enter DFU if you're going to upgrade the version of the nano VNA. So that didn't do anything. So that's why I thought that resetting it wasn't going to help. But I couldn't solve the problem, so I kept on clicking around. And lo and behold, in a couple of menus, buried in a couple of menus down, I see another reset, but it said reset all. And I went, wow, what's this? So since it was useless to me, I hit that, reset all, and the thing resetted to its initial settings, and my problems were solved. Now all the readings, all the SWR sweeps, all the resistance values, everything is just exactly the way it is on the Rig Expert Rig Expert VNA I have. And it's back to a pleasure to use. So these things, I guess, can get corrupted, especially mine, which is not shielded. They come either shielded or not shielded, and I was unlucky enough to get one that's not shielded. So I guess they get corrupted more easily. But if you have a problem with it, just go to reset all, and you won't ruin anything. It'll just reset to the basic kernel version that's in your nano DNA. So that's the way I solved it. Back to you, Roy.
AC2ZV.
Yes, William.
Hi. I'm on Echolink, so that's why delay, but Yeah, I had one of those nano VNAs without the case, and it didn't work at all for me. And so that was really kind of disappointing. And so I bothered Roy about it. Anyway, recently I got a new one that is in a case, and I got the little board thing with it. I haven't had time to play with it. You know, it has different impedances and stuff. You can plug in different tiny connectors on the board, to, and then it's a calibration required. So it seems like you know what you're doing. So you have another VNA, and do you have to calibrate it in a frequency band before you use it? And could you go some general practices for us?
Well, I don't know if that was addressed to me, but I found, believe it or not, they say practices is that every time you change frequency range, you should recalibrate it. So after I fixed mine, I recalibrated it and then changed frequency range, and it didn't make a difference on an SWR sweep. Maybe it'll make a difference on other types of readings, but I use it basically for an SWR sweep, and it made no difference at all when I did a sweep from 3.5 megahertz to 30 megahertz or 144 megahertz to 450 megahertz and read my NFED shortened NFED half wave, the dips, you know, the trace was exactly the same. So I'm not an expert, but it did make a difference. And Roy, I wonder if you know more about you have to calibrate or I answered that question. I don't have to calibrate to just do an SWR sweep, but maybe there were other functions. Calibration is really important. Back to Matt.
Abbott. Thank you very much, Rich. It's good practice, at least for the nano VNA. Most of the documentation that I've seen urges people to calibrate it if you make any kind of changes in frequencies. You might get away with it, but you know, you could never really ultimately rely on it. DFU, by the way, is device firmware update. It was used a lot in Apple products. If your device was practically bricked, it was the mode to kind of send it back to just be a hard drive device, and then you would just transfer the firmware data into it, and it would reboot the firmware. So that's where DFU comes in. All these vector network analyzers should regularly be calibrated. You usually get three different connectors. One is a 50 ohm nominal connector. The other is an open connector, and the other is a shorted connector. So infinite resistance, zero resistance, and 50 ohms resistance. And you should calibrate all VNAs at one point or another. There are some VNAs that are much more tolerant, and as long as you don't change the amount of transmission line you're going through and such, and alter characteristics a lot, you don't necessarily have to calibrate regularly. But generally, what I've read about nano VNAs is they kind of urge you to calibrate it as a habit, just in case. You might get away with it, but you might not, and you won't know until you know.
AC2ZV.
Yes, William.
Okay, so I tried this calibration thing, and it's a lot of work, you know, screwing around with unscrewing and screwing in. So I decided it would be a good idea to get a switch, and so I have a switch. It only, unfortunately, is a three-way switch, so I had to put a two-way switch in front of the three-way switch to do the open, short, and load for the calibration. But do you think adding the switches in front of that actually screws things up, or do you think that's actually going to be a good idea?
It probably screws things up. I've never known anyone who've done it quite like that. I've used those calibration connectors, and they're not the most fun I've had, but they didn't really strike me as a terrible nuisance. I guess theoretically, if you wanted to make them easier, you could put some bayonet connectors over them. The problem is, though, that if you're using a three-way switch or a three-way and a two-way switch, then you have to, then you've calibrated it with that switch in line. So you then have to theoretically use it with the switch. If you take the switch out, then it's a different configuration. That's what I was kind of getting at, that if you have odd transmission lines involved part of the time, you need to recalibrate. So I would not recommend the method that you have chosen. I think it's probably easiest and safest to just suffer through by, you know, screwing them on and screwing them off. Again, I guess theoretically you can get a bayonet to make it a little bit easier, and then you have the same bayonet as part of your testing setup as well, so it will calibrate for the BNC. But I think that the switch is not a good idea.
W2BC. Roy, you're exactly right, because I've seen YouTubes where someone has added just like a 4 or 5 inch leader off of the nano DNA before they plug anything into the other side of the leader, and they recalibrate it for the leader. So anything that you attach to it, you have to recalibrate for that added attachment, and switches definitely would need to be recalibrated. You'd need to recalibrate it after you put on a switch.
Yeah, but the point is I leave the switch in line all the time.
Well, but you're using, the problem you have there is you're using a switch with three different connectors where one of them is the short, one of them is the open, one of them is the 50. And because nothing is identical, each of those is a different situation. So you're not really properly, the calibration should be all things being equal, presenting those three different resistances to the VNA. What you're doing is you're piping in one through connector A, one through switch connector B, and one through switch connector C. So it's not guaranteed to be identical. That's where the problem is.
Yeah, you would have to unscrew and screw different the load, the through, and the short. You'd have to unscrew and screw them on the other side of the switch, on the same port of the switch, to be able to calibrate it, and that'll defeat your reason for the switch.
82 MYF.
Sperlot?
I have a question that is a little bit unrelated. I heard a lot of time people talking about having wires inside of the apartment instead of outside antenna. I would like to have some advice on that, like especially people living in small, apartments. I would like to have an idea whether or not it's a good thing to do.
Okay, we can discuss that. I just want to make sure that we finished up with William's question or comment. Any other points you want to make, William? I agree with Rich. If you're going to use the switch as a single connection for the three calibration values, you could, but it you lose the benefit, so you might as well just do it the old-fashioned way. But if you have any comments, please feel free.
AC2ZV. I'm just going to try it out, and then I'll report back to you later, let you know how well it works or not. I get the idea why you're cautioning me. But it's not like I'm critical, like I'm sending up SpaceX rockets.
Okay. You feel free to do, there's no law against it. The only problem is that if you don't compare the two different techniques, you may find the results tolerable, although slightly awry. But, you're free to try it out and come back and tell us how it works. Just in general out there, I wouldn't kind of suggest that. I would try to have the calibrations based on the same identical connections set up for all three of the different values. But try it out and see what happens. So, and thanks for participating tonight, William. So let me drop and I'll come right back and we'll pick up Berlot's question. Okay, Berlot, you can put your antenna inside. It is not the greatest idea, but if that's the only choice you have, if your choice is no antenna or an internal antenna, then you're better off ultimately with an internal antenna. There are different factors that make internal antennas better ideas or worse ideas. A big aspect is what is the nature of the insulation in your apartment. My house was built in the late 1950s before plasterboard became very popular. So what the technique was back then was to have the 2x4 studs, staple chicken wire, and then put regular plaster over it and smooth it out. Which was much more intensive work and has gone out of fashion because plasterboard is a lot quicker and easier. But with the chicken wire, effectively, you have something called a Faraday cage, which means that very little to no radio waves can pass through my walls. So I've had test antennas in my house that were terrible. I took them outside and they were much, 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 much better. There are people, though, who have less amount of conducting material and not Faraday cages surrounding each room, and they will staple wires up on their walls. And as long as you don't sit too close to them, because RF can have deleterious effects if you're too close to it, they get the job done. There are people who put a mag mount 2-meter antennas on their refrigerator in their kitchen, and they get by. It's not a perfect situation. The best situation for an antenna, given the choice of inside or outside, would be outside. And also, the best is higher than lower, all things being equal. So, but if you can't get it outside, as Theodore has found, if you can get it close to a window, you have a better chance, especially if you have a Faraday cage for the plaster walls. But, you know, if you don't have that problem with your plaster walls, you might get away with stringing them up on a long side of a wall and then seeing what happens.
My 2-meter radio right now, but I just bought a 10-meter radio so I can do 10-meter. So I'm concerned about, you know, where I will put the second antenna. So that's why I was, you know, asking that question to see what's my option. Back to you.
As I mentioned before, outside is much better than inside. So if you can poke it out your window, that will probably be much more effective than if you keep it on the other side of your window. The way it works is, for all intents and purposes, the worst is in the middle of your house, then followed by at your window, where you might end up having some shielding from infrared that's also going to trap some of your radio waves, and the best is on the other side of your window. So if you can get it to the other side of the window, that's best. If you can't, then keep it close to the outside near the window if you can. If you can't do that, then you stick it on a wall and you hope for the best.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Once again, this is AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month, starting at 9 p.m. and going for as long as anyone is interested. I will ask again if there's anyone out there who has any technical questions or topics that they would like to discuss tonight. Please feel free hit that push to talk and tell us about it.
Net Control, this is KD2VEA.
Yes, Maxim.
I'm using Echolink tonight, just something different. I wanted to ask you a little bit about Vox. Going back to our conversation some time ago, last TechNet, I was looking to transmit the ARRL news over the radio, so I did buy that cable that on Amazon. What's interesting is that I was trying to mess around with playing through. Was trying to set up Vox on my radio so it would pick it up and play. If I would hold the key down, if I PTT key down, then transmission comes through and I can hear it in the audio stream going back to me. But what's odd is that so the Vox does not want to pick it up, because it would be nice to just be able to turn on Vox, press play on the device and play through. It's the first time I try playing with it. Any suggestions there? Am I making any cardinal mistakes?
Well, I have not ever tried Vox on, I believe you were using a Baofeng. I've never even looked into it. Sometimes these things are not terribly effective. Sometimes it's a matter of the audio level. You might not have been supplying enough audio level to trigger the Vox. It should have a setting for that, but again, I'm not quite sure because I've never really looked into the Baofengs for Vox features. Theoretically, you might be able to kind of rig up a little, if it's tiring to keep the button down, I can understand. You could probably figure out a little external trigger rather than a push-to-talk button. It could be just a toggle switch, and so you could just kind of toggle it and play it and then untoggle it. It probably would be the easiest approach, I would think. But again, if anyone else out there has more expertise in using Baofengs for Vox operation, please feel free to share.
W2BZ. I had a 2 hour and 15 minute QSO on 10 meters yesterday, and the guy was using Vox, and it was very pleasurable, because he said that I could interject anything and he'll hear me. And a couple of times I did when he was talking, and he was talking a lot for 2.5 hour or 2 hour and 10 minute, whatever it was. It was over 2 hours, QSO. He was in Mississippi near New Orleans. Anyway, I don't think that it would be possible to plug something into a Baofeng for it to know that it's supposed to switch from transmit to receive through a voltage change. I would tend to doubt it. Maybe I'm wrong, Roy, but it seems very unlikely. Back to net.
Okay. I have no expertise whatsoever in setting it to operate as Vox while you were talking. I typed into Google and saw some people kind of discussing that some things that should work with Vox don't seem to be working with Vox. And, you know, they're discussing that there are perhaps the kind of different levels of utility. When you have a base station that does Vox, it's not quite the same as a Baofeng. The great lie is, it seems like there are several levels of Vox. Maybe you have the detect level set too high, or you need more audio volume from the sound card, which is sort of what I suggested a little bit earlier. So I think that there is a Vox, but I think it's kind of iffy. And if you felt like you wanted to take a little bit of a chance, you might try increasing the audio signal. So maybe it just needs a higher amplitude signal to trigger its Vox versus you just triggering the push to talk manually. Or again, you could just build a relatively simple toggle switch to replace the push to talk button and deal with it that way.
Yep. So what's interesting, so there's some, I've studied a little bit of research playing with yesterday. So I have the AnyTone 878 radio. So there are three levels of aux. Funny enough, that level one, there's one, two, and three. One is actually the most sensitive, but three is the least sensitive. So I kind of try to play with all three. A couple of things I'm going to try. One is what I read is that I can't program from the radio interface whether to use internal or external radio for internal or external microphone for aux. I think that's something I can only do through the programming interface. So I'm going to have to connect it to a computer and get that figured out. Maybe it's set to the internal only, and then that's what I need to set so it actually starts picking it up. So that's one thing I got to play around with. The other thing is that I was connecting to my iPhone through a dongle. Maybe that dongle is preventing it from working, although through a PTT it worked. I'm going to keep playing around, but it should be interesting because when I was holding the PTT down, I think my William last night mentioned that the audio is coming in much more crisp. So it gives us an ability to have the ARRL news on the net again. I'm going to keep playing around with it. Seems like an interesting thing. And Roy, thank you for, because I saw that wire, but then when you sent me those couple articles and that piece kind of made me a little bit more comfortable trying it out. The wire does have some protection against volumes that are too high, so to pump too much power into the radio, but I'm going to try to keep it low. I also did take a look at SignalLinks, very interesting devices. I might at some point want to take a look at that for digital operation, but for now, I'm going to play around with this and see what happens. This is KD2VEA.
AC2GS. Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I wasn't aware that it had an internal switch to dealing with its internal microphone versus its plug-in microphone. So, yeah, maybe that's simply what's going on, that it thinks it should be hearing it out of its microphone instead of the line going into it. So give that a try, and if it works for you, even if it doesn't work for you, come back in some future technical net and tell us so that we'll learn a little something new about AnyTone 878s.
That I will do. And quick question on that other device, the audio device you mentioned, SignalLink. Have you tried using those for FT8 or anything like that, digital mode communication?
I have not. I've used, well, yeah, my Flex 6700 has a built-in virtual audio channel, so I don't need to use something like SignalLink. I have SignalLink connected to, I have SignalLink connected to a TYT. I have it connected to the FT400 so that I can do some of this EchoLink magic. None of which really lends itself to FT8. But theoretically, you should be able to. There's nothing to stop you from doing it. It supplies you with the proper output-input audio and the push-to-talk enabling line, so it should work fine. It's just that I don't need it for my Flex 6700. As it is, you know, it all runs through a computer networking Ethernet cable.
2ZV.
Yes, William?
I wanted to mention that my Battlefung has a two actual connectors that go into the side for the microphone, and one I think is the audio and the other is the push-to-talk switch. So there's two different jacks that plug into the side. So probably one is the audio and the other is the push-to-talk. So if you have the ARL audio news, you could just maybe like have a switch on the push-to-talk thing and it'll key the Baofeng to take the audio input through the mic connector. You need like a Y connector on the mic, but I think you can work that out.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, yes. Part of those connections is an external push-to-talk. The thing is, though, the Baofengs are not quite as complicated, but all these things are a little bit more complicated than you would think, because for the most part, a lot of these things also have a RS-232 or a serial interface for programming features in it as well. So you have to kind of know exactly which pin does what. But as long as you look it up properly and you use the proper pin configuration, you should be able to make an external push-to-talk momentary or a toggle switch, whatever you like.
Well, it's KG2VA. I will keep trying and we'll come back here and let you know what my progress is. At the minimum, hopefully we'll be able to play the ARL news like we used to, with a little bit better quality than me holding my iPhone to a microphone. So stay tuned. But always something fun.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Max, for participating. I thank everyone for participating in this experience. And once again, I am AC2GS, and this is the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Net. If anyone has any other questions, please feel free. Hit that push to talk or whatever works for you and give us your question or your comment. Well, once again, this is AC2GS. If anyone has any questions, feel free to ask them. If we don't get any questions, I guess we'll move on to our puzzle for tonight. I hope people have pulled it up on their webpage, because it is a very short schematic. It's basically a voltage divider network. It's a question. Hopefully people will get the idea of what the question means, and they should be able to answer it. Anyway, if there's any other questions, though, we'll go to another question. Otherwise, we'll go to the puzzle. So if anyone has a question, please hit that push-to-talk button. Okay, I guess everyone's questioned out. Well, the puzzle for tonight, it is a little diagram. It's four resistors, two pairs of resistors. Each of them is in series with each other, and the two pairs are parallel to each other. And there are contacts between the serial resistors, and the question is, a voltmeter is connected across points M and N. What will it read? And you have four choices. Your first choice is 0 volts potential. Second one is 15 volts. By the way, it's 50 volts is the amount of voltage potential on the entire resistance voltage dividing bridge. So the first answer is 0 volts, second is 15 volts, third is 25 volts, and the fourth D is 35 volts. So would anyone like to hazard a guess of what the voltage difference between the points M and N might be?
2ZV.
Yes, William, you have a suggestion?
Having a hard time pulling the puzzle up. It comes up to 2022, but I don't get a 2023. So I was listening to what you said, and I need to hear the question again. I'm sorry. Maybe you could give me the website for the puzzle, puzzle.itdoesntseemtobeworking.com, and I'll get that straight, and then maybe somebody else will answer.
Okay, let me just try myself, because I'm sure that I checked it weeks and weeks and weeks ago when I made the switch, and it should land you there, but I will check. So give me a few seconds, and I will tell you if it's coming up right or wrong. And it's coming up right, so I don't know. It's puzzles.kc2rc.com.
Worked for me. This is KG2VA.
Screwed up. I just in one puzzle. I didn't put puzzle with a plural. That's why it wasn't working.
Okay. Now that you got it up, take a look, and if you want to, suggest what the answer might be.
ZV.
Yes, William.
0 volts.
Yes, indeed. It is 0 volts. And the reason why it's 0 volts is you'll notice that basically there are two resistance voltage bridges and voltage dividers, and they're dividing it by the same ratio. So the voltage potential of M is the same voltage potential as N. Now, if you didn't connect the voltmeter to M and N, but you connected one, say, to M and the top lead of the 50 volts or the bottom lead of the 50 volts, you'd be reading different voltage potentials. But because the voltage dividers are identical, they're both at the same potential. So as far as the difference between the two, it's zero, so the voltage is zero. So you are quite right, William. Any other comments or questions about this or anything before we kind of call it a night?
C2ZV. Yeah, it's a little late for me. I could talk to you about ancient aliens for a while, but I think we'll save that for another day.
Okay, very, very well, William. I used to read von Däniken books when I was a little kid. So I kind of know about those things, and I tried reading about all kinds of things when I was little, and thankfully I got it out of my system.
Well, it turns out it is the thriving industry.
Well, William, there are many things that are thriving industries, not necessarily good things, but that's the point. If you could make a buck off of it, then it continues. As long as there's some guy out there willing to buy the book, someone's going to write the book.
Nice thing, though, is they put their promo out on YouTube, and if you can stand the commercials, it doesn't cost anything to get all these crazy ideas.
Okay, but you got to be careful because I'm always concerned that they're kind of like mind viruses, that they'll bury themselves in your brain and you come up with strange ideas. If they're really strange, little bits of it amuse me. I found a YouTube where usually I try for the YouTubes where they're telling about these crazy people as opposed to listening directly to the crazy people, because then the algorithm just ends up giving me a lot of crazy people. There are guys out there who believe that jet engines don't use jet fuel. They because they see them revving up the motors on the ground, these strange people think that that's what's really running it has a perpetual motion machine in it, and they rev up the jets on the ground and it takes off, and they really don't use any of the fuel, and they just say that they use the fuel because that way they make more money from people who fly on the planes. So they're quite mad.
I don't usually buy into those things, but the most recent thing I found out was that they discovered voids inside the Great Pyramids, and then they were able to stick an endoscope in there and actually see that there was an empty cave in there that was built. And then there's another void that they found using these cosmic radiations from detectors and stuff inside the pyramid above the Great Hall. So it's going to happen soon. They're going to announce that one next, and we're going to see if they allow somebody to dig into that or what's going to happen.
Okay, I don't quite... no one really kind of definitively said that the pyramids were solid. The pyramids were burial tombs for the pharaohs. And so there were little cavities all over the place with a lot of them were blind cavities so that people got lost. But eventually, if you found your way to the big one, that's where the tomb was and all the riches were kept for the pharaohs to take with them to the next world. So, you know, it doesn't particularly amaze me that there are cavities in pyramids. You know, there was no particular reason to build it 100% solid, just to build it securely and to make it difficult for people to steal, although people still somehow stole a lot of stuff in these burials.
I think it's interesting is the technology that's required, you know, to put these... they're actually, like, surveying the muons as they're going through the wind that goes through the earth, and they can tell as the earth turns, you know, the different densities throughout the pyramid, and they have detectors in there, and they use all the software to figure out where the voids are. Those very interesting technology that is going around these days.
Yes, I agree with you. There are detectors for particles that have only been known about for less than 100 years. And most of those times, they couldn't detect them in a portable type of, you know, non-laboratory environment. So, yeah, there's all kinds of interesting things. They measure neutrinos that travel through the entire Earth and come out the other end. Because neutrinos are very, very, very weakly interactive with every other field out there. And so we have billions of neutrinos just flying through our body every second. You know, thankfully, we're unaware of that.
Maybe not. Who knows if that changes our moods?
Well, since they're not really interactive, I doubt that they do much of anything as far as we're concerned. But it's a constant. You know, the sun is pouring out neutrinos. It's part of the debris of fusion. You know, among other things, among the gamma rays and the helium. Nuclei of alpha particles, electrons, beta particles, and gamma rays are neutrinos. They were the last things to be detected because they really don't interact much. So you need trillions and trillions of them to go through large amounts of sensor material to even detect their presence.
That's how these sensors work inside the pyramid, so I don't know that much about it, but I think it's fascinating that they're able to do this kind of stuff and then go through all this rigmarole to get permission to stick a little camera in there and take a little picture. Well, we'll see what happens when they get to the other void, but it's going to be probably a long time because nobody wants them drilling into the pyramid.
Well, I mean, that's understandable. These are historic objects. They've been weathered down through many, 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 many years. The Sphinx doesn't have a nose anymore. Nature of all great landmarks is eventually they'll just kind of collapse in on themselves. So no one wants to speed things up. So I certainly understand the Egyptian government doesn't want people to play around with their pyramids.
Same time, they're promoting tourism.
Well, look, you can come, you can look at it, you can snap pictures of it, you can spend money in Egypt, of course, but that doesn't mean that they would like you to chip a piece off and take it home with you.
Why it takes so long to get permission. They know what they're doing.
Well, it isn't like it hasn't happened before. Napoleon and his troops basically lifted all that they could lift out of Egypt when they ran the place. So, you know, they've had people kind of steal them blind, and it still goes on in the Middle East. You know, every so often you read in the newspaper that some import agent was found to be dealing in stolen merchandise, you know, after the Iraqi war and such. So it's still going on. There's a lot of money, again, to be made doing that. And so people are going to steal relics and sell them to rich guys who can't show them to anyone because they're stolen. or they'll make up a story that they weren't stolen. Hobby Lobby, I think, invested into a lot of those artifacts that were later found to be stolen.
We could really, really thank Napoleon for actually finding the Rosetta Stone and bringing it back, because otherwise nobody would know anything about the Egyptian hieroglyphics, because that's what got everything started with the translations.
Well, you know, there were less imperial ways of doing it, and if anything, I would probably credit, I forget his name, unfortunately, the linguist who figured it out, because at first, they weren't quite sure what the heck it was. And then they realized, because it had hieroglyphics, and I think it had Coptic. And Coptic is still a language in Egypt. And I think up until that point, they had no idea that Coptic and hieroglyphics was at all related. And so, you know, once they figured that out, and then, of course, the Greek wasn't that difficult, but the kind of correlating it with the hieroglyphics and the Coptic was, I think, the breakthrough. So it wasn't like, you know, Napoleon or one of his generals brought it in, and the first guy who took a look at the stone said, aha, it's a dictionary. Now, it took a little time. It took a very clever linguist.
I agree with you on that. But then again, that rock could still be the foundation of some kind of fort. I saw plenty of stuff in Egypt that was made of rebuilt stones from all over the place when I was there. And I just think that was a really lucky call that he got that and brought it back for everybody to see.
Well, I agree with you. If you've ever seen replicas, there's a lot of replicas out there. It looks like it's valuable, so I could sort of understand. And of course, people have reused historic stuff over and over and over again, because Egypt has been a somewhat poor country for a long, long time now. Despite the fact that it was one of the two first great civilizations in the Middle East, Mesopotamia and Egypt kind of came into being approximately around the same time. The grandeur that was, Egypt was consistently a power in that area for thousands of years. Mesopotamia kind of had its peaks and valleys historically. Civilizations came and went and came and went and came and went and came and went. The first Mesopotamians apparently weren't Semitics, because the language wasn't Semitic, but the next major Mesopotamian civilization all of a sudden used Semitic language. So they were not the same genetic people. They just had the same location. And, you know, it goes on and on and on until you get to Babylon, I guess, was the last great civilization in that little area, unless you want to talk about Assyria and then there's Persia. History is fascinating.
I don't think there's much more time for tonight, but I thought the Egyptian discovery was interesting, and thanks a lot for your comments.
Well, thank you as well. And Michael, KE2AAHH, who's on EchoLink, made a comment in the text field. Egypt started about 3,000 years B.C., I think, he said. And the point being that both Mesopotamia and Egypt began, probably 5,000 years ago. They started not quite as they are remembered. There was really two kingdoms. And the kingdoms were merged when one pharaoh kind of conquered the other. In matter of fact, there is a ceremonial headdress for the Upper Nile and the Lower Nile civilizations, and they merged them together in future pharaohs. And, you know, there have been different ruling groups through the years. And one time, an invasion group took over Egypt for, I think, something like 40, 50 years, and then they were thrown out eventually. They were more stable than Mesopotamia, but yeah, it goes all the way back.
Yep, and then it goes back farther and farther behind that, and that's the real question.
Well, I mean, obviously it goes farther back because human beings have probably wandered the Earth for a few hundred thousand years, but ancient civilizations that left anything behind, there's not much you can find if you go any farther back than the Mesopotamians and the Egyptians. You might find some shards of nondescript pottery, some Neolithic structures that are probably temporary. Not a long-term of hunter and gatherer types. So there were human beings, but whether or not there was much of a civilization to speak of is highly unlikely. Civilizations with cities and such usually leave something a little bit more significant than we've so far found if you go back before about 5,000-6,000 years.
The thing is, we really don't know. And we don't know how they were able to carve those stones and do what they did with all those stones when they were supposed to be so primitive. And so that is the big question.
Well, I mean, now you're hitting into von Daniken. And I always disliked von Daniken because the whole premise is not respecting, you know, people. Human beings can often be very clever and very inventive. And the Egyptians were not primitive people by far. Egyptians had an incredibly sophisticated understanding of astronomy and geometry and a lot of other things that most people don't give them credit for. So it's not like they were a bunch of, you know, cavemen. And, you know, it's clever work on their part to build the pyramids, but it wasn't impossible. The Nile was a great transportation method. And if you have a lot of people, and Egypt had a large population of well-fed people, and you had a lot of rope, it's amazing what a lot of people and a lot of rope can do. All those enormous monoliths in what's that island that has those big stone figures? You know, people have already demonstrated that with a bunch of average people and some rope, you can tip it this way and that and move it miles. So I don't think space aliens were necessary. I think the Egyptians were a sophisticated culture with a lot of understanding of a lot of things. So I don't think that they were particularly primitive.
Okay, Roy. I'm with you on that, and I think I got to call it a night. Thanks a lot for all your comments.
Okay, thank you for your participation. Again, Michael, KE2AHH, remembered it's Easter Island with the large statues. So, you know, human beings are capable of incredibly great things and incredibly terrible things. And, you know, I don't dismiss the evil that we've done, but we do things that are glorious. We build things from our imagination and our cleverness. And, you know, it only makes me marvel more at humanity. What high the heights and how low the depths we could go. but that's for another philosophical net. Anyway, this is AC2GS. This has been the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month, starting at 9 p.m., and we go for as long as anyone's interested. If anyone has any other comments, questions, statements, topics, what have you, if you're still around out there and you want to mention them, then you better do it now before I shut it down. So hit that push to talk.
Hey, Katie, over and out.
Oh, hello, Laura. I didn't notice you. When did you step in?
3 seconds ago.
Okay, so I wasn't as unobservant as I thought I might have been. Well, I'm glad you at least came by to listen to the end.
Thank you so much. I hope everybody's well and staying safe.
Well, likewise, Laura. I wish everyone a safe week. And I hope Purim is going well for those who are involved in it. Once again, I am AC2GS. Before I call this an end to our little technical net for tonight, if there's anyone else with any other closing comments that they'd like to share, please hit that push to talk.
QNV was an interesting factoid I just picked up.
Sure, Bob.
Yes, as you might know, one of my other hobbies is birding, and I was reading a birding magazine, and scientists have determined that birds actually, among other things, actually can sense the Earth's magnetic field for navigating, specifically, especially when they're like migrating long distances, and when the other methods, you know, like visibility and such, are not serving them well. They think they rely on this, and this article was about why there's so many like stray birds, which is like when you suddenly see a bird that's supposed to only be in Europe and it's spotted in New York or something. This happens from time to time. And the theory that, you know, that birds may even sort of see magnetic fields, and things like sunspot cycles, which are good for hams, could possibly mess up birds. Any kind of like the electromagnetic disruptions. I just found that really interesting. So throw that back to you. I don't know if you'd ever heard that fact before or not. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I've heard, because, I mean, that's a big question. A lot of birds go very, very long distances back and forth as the changing seasons. And how do they know it's not like they got a compass on them. So they have a built-in method. Sometimes people suggesting they have little magnetite crystals and they're able to detect the magnetic field. And there are other options. I thought you were going to mention, I had linked last Limark Technical Net to an article where they were talking about they've been kind of looking into birdsong, and they believe that birds are capable of effectively using contractions where they contract the birdsong to a shortened version that the way that we shorten words with contractions. So I thought you were going to mention birds using contractions.
Sort of heard something similar to that how bird songs can seem to change, almost like another birding article I read, like some, you know, people attracted some kind of bird in some region, how it was starting to change. It was almost like people's accents or culturally expressions or something kind of evolve and change a bit over the generations of so they were noticing something like that in birds. So maybe it's similar. So it was something like that. And the other thing I noticed, I've read that it's pretty well established that a lot of birds, they see colors, they see ultraviolet, a lot of birds. I'm not sure if it's all birds or just a lot of birds, like specifically like hummingbirds. Those bright colors, you see some of those birds to each other, that they look even more bright because they can see not only like, what is it, I might be getting this wrong, like this light and that light forms that color, like what is it, red and blue is green, I might have this wrong, I'm forgetting which is light and which is pigment. but they can see other things like a combination of red and ultraviolet or a combination of things like that. So they have a whole nother spectrum of colors that they can see because they can see the ultraviolet spectrum, and it's probably used for whatever mating or what have you. Anyway, throwing those bird facts around. Back to you.
Yeah, birds are, they call that tetrachromats. Insects also are able to see UV. So whereas we see blue, green, and red, they see UV, blue, green, and red. But most mammals don't. Most mammals not only did they lose the UV, most mammals lost the ability to perceive the color red. That's why it's kind of funny that people still think that bulls get upset when you wave a red cloth in front of their face. They don't like the cloth in general. They have no idea it's the color red. For some odd reason, primates kind of redeveloped that red photo in our retina. So among mammals, it's a very rare thing to not be colorblind for the color red.
Interesting. So most mammals only have two color cones or sensors, and then humans and primates have three, and then these birds and insects must have four. Back to you.
Yep, that's the way it appears to be. You know, it's kind of difficult to even imagine what that must feel like. It's one of those things, you know, when people kind of get a little bit too philosophical for a bunch of different reasons. You know, do you see the same red that I see? Because there's no real way for us to kind of look in on each brain to know that the red, the thing that I call red and the thing that you call red might not look the same. If I was looking into your brain and you were looking into my brain, we just take it for granted that when we say red, it's all the same color.
Right, just so that the thing it's the same thing that looks, everybody thinks is red. Yeah, I think about that because I'm one of those people who has it's sort of a mild color blindness, you call it. It's not so uncommon in men. It's much more uncommon in women because they have to get it from both parents. But it's like those number charts where you're supposed to see a number. I don't see the number. I just see a bunch of dots. So, but as far as I know, I see all the colors, but they obviously don't look. I've ever as a kid seen the World Book Encyclopedia explaining, well, this is what that looks like to someone like me who's partly colorblind. it looked more bland to me. So you're looking at it, I guess I'm seeing it more blandly than other people, so I'm missing out on some things. But, you know, I get into photography. I'm a little insecure when I'm doing stuff like trying to balance the colors. Am I seeing it well enough to do this? But it's interesting. How do other people see that, you know? I'll never know.
Yeah, it's sort of amazing. Yeah, there are different degrees of color blindness, and the tests usually test for different levels of it. So, in those weird pictures with the little with the spheres that are different colored, and you're asked, you know, what figure do you see in them, and such. They have different degrees of the color in them to tell the difference between severe red color blindness and mild to moderate red color blindness.
I forget the percentage.
Bird watching.
Small minority, I guess, of men that have this, but it's far from rare. It's probably it's some kind of percentage. It might be less than 10%. It might be more than 10%. I just don't remember.
Okay, message I get on the text field from Laura. Laura wants to know where you go birding. So if you could tell her that.
Okay, to NVB. Yeah, well, I'm one of those people they call a pandemic birder. I got into it during the pandemic when it was on a back shelf of my brain interest for a few decades. I suddenly found the time, and anyway, where I live, very close to Prospect Park, and there's some good place. It's a good place to go. So is Central Park, and so I could just walk there, 5-10 minute walk. And there's an area called the Vale of Kashmir that's fairly close to the Grand Army Plaza entrance to the park, which is the part of the park that I'm close to. There are other parts you can go. I mean, if you want to look at water birds, there's the whole lake there, and there's other areas. You Google it, because that's what I did. I Googled, like, where are the good places, you know, like in the park, and I Googled, and I got the answer. And you can see maps of the park. The Vale Kashmir, yeah, it's a pretty close walk from that entrance. I go there a lot.
Okay, very good. Laura mentioned that she used to go birding there as well. So it's a place that I assume she's well aware of. Something weird, when you let go of the repeater, it kind of hiccups for a little while.
It's my own fault. It's this damn microphone that I've never fixed the plug. I'm holding it right now, and if I don't hold it exactly right, sometimes it's a mild problem or none. Right now it's doing a lot of that disconnecting and connecting. I think that's what's going on. It's like Kerchunking it or something.
Okay, you know, I'm sure you'll get to it one of these days.
I hope to. It's worse than ever right now. I think maybe I should just sign off. Back to you.
Well, I assume we're pretty much close to the end. If anyone has any closing comments, feel free. And then if there's nothing that comes back, I'll give you my little going away message, and we'll call it a week. Okay. Once again, thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I appreciate it. I've never seen that many people on the Echo Link. So thanks to each and every one of you on the Echo Link. Thanks for everyone on the radio. And I hope you'll come back in future sessions. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be April 5th, which will be held by teleconference. Also, we have the hybrid meeting, so if you're interested in eyeball meetings, contact William, AC2ZV, and ask for a seat, because they're limited seating. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join the general meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. And we also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m., approximately on 28.380 upper sideband. If we're off frequency, I will post the differing frequency on the front page of our club website. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet as well as our 10-meter net. Just type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by a local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank for their generosity. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. Well, it's time to roll this all up and shut it all down, but we'll be back here March 22nd, and you're all welcome to join us. Again, thanks to all the people that participated tonight, especially my co-host, Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So, this is AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Have a great week, and we'll talk down the line. This is AC2GS, and I am clear.